Thank you, guys. Thank you for inviting me. I'll just put the timer on.
Yeah, that's true. So, yeah, so
I have like, you know, a talk that is, if I wanted to kind of give it in full, it would be about an hour. I might skip some parts of it, you know, kind of like we're kind of a small crowd for kind of informal discussion. So kind of please feel free to interrupt me and talk about it.
There's a lot of different topics that I covered that
might not kind of just like all kind of stitched together very naturally. So it would be good to have that. I would love to kind of like take the moment to acknowledge like my driver is Lamasco. Working with me, kind of being, it's kind of basically a joint collaboration between us about all this stuff about machine learning. And Neil, who is here, has been some of the work that I'll share with you, kind of like, especially pre-machine learning, was kind of just, you know, in very intense collaboration with Neil. And so the outline of the talk in general is that I'll kind of introduce strong lensing, a little bit about like what it is. I'll talk about one of the key questions that we'd like to answer with strong lensing about dark matter and then kind of like talk about like how we do that, like how we use strong lensing to probe dark matter on these scales. And then, you know, I'll kind of go to machine learning work and talk about like, you know, why we're doing machine learning, what are kind of the works that we were doing there. Then I'll kind of briefly just mention a few other projects that are beyond lensing. So in other areas of cosmology and machine learning. And I'll kind of like mention this new initiative that we have in Montreal for research at the intersection of machine learning and astrophysics. So let's start with strong lensing. So strong lensing is the formation of multiple images of a background source because of the deflection of its light rays by the gravity of foreground objects. So, you know, here, if you are on the Earth on the left, as you know, and we have like two galaxies, as the light rays of, I don't know if you can see this video. Oh, I don't know why we cannot see it. So, for whatever reason, my keynote has decided that some things are not going to show today. I'll just kind of like skip to this slide and then talk about it. So this is a strong gravity plane. So the idea is that the light rays of the background source, they come near the foreground structure and they get bent and they come to us from different directions. And so as a result, we see these kind of arc, like, you know, you see two arcs and two, you know, multiple images of a background source around this foreground object. And so if I go back here, and it's a little bit like looking at the images of a fish tank. You know, kind of like fish at the corner of a fish tank. If you've noticed, you see two different images, and that's because the light is from the two different sides are getting bent because of refraction and coming to us from two different angles. And so here's like a, you know, little video of that showing, this is like Mr. Mango going to the corner, and you can see two different images. And it's simple, but you have to wait a long time to capture that moment. So, so you see this is an actual gravitational lens in the sky. So you see these orange lens of galaxy making two different images of the background quasar that is behind it. Except that the difference here is that, of course, here the bending of light is because of gravity instead of refraction, as is the case in the fish tank. And quite often when we look at these galaxy strong lenses, there's like a few different classes of strong lenses. When the background and the foreground are galaxies, you see these arc-like structures like the blue one that you see, and that's because of the geometry of the lensing structure, right? So if you have like a wine glass and you put it in front of a candle, you see similar kind of distortions where the image of the candle flame basically becomes these arc-like structures. So I'll use this analogy throughout the talk. So you have the background candle, which is the background galaxy. This light is getting distorted, getting to be these arcs. And you have the wine glass, the foot of the wine glass as the lensing galaxy distorting the image of the background source. So there you see, I just go back, one gravitational lens that just appeared briefly, the horseshoe lens, just to show that. And so strong lensing overall can be used for three main categories of sciences that we do with it. So either we use it for the studying the background galaxy, or the foreground structure, or to constrain cosmology. And so for the background galaxy, the main idea is that because gravitational lensing magnifies these images, it makes them bigger, it makes them brighter, we can use it as a natural telescope. to study some things, you know, like that are kind of like at the limit of our resolution or sensitivity kind of like threshold. So within the SPT-SMG collaboration for the past like more than 10 years, I've been working basically using these gravitational lenses to study star-forming galaxies at very high redshift, at redshift 7. Hey, these are some of the first galaxies that formed in the universe. And the reason that we can observe them is that they are undergoing this magnification with gravitational lensing. They're brighter and they're bigger. We could also use lensing to probe the matter distribution in the foreground galaxy. And so here the idea is that the distortions in the
images are caused by gravity. So if I can learn how this distortion is caused, I can map the gravitational field or the distribution of matter in the foreground structures. And this is particularly interesting, as you can imagine, for studying dark matter. And finally, there's another aspect of lensing that has to do with primarily maybe with time delays these days. And that has to do with the fact that these different images that we observe, they have basically different arrival times because of like, you know, two different factors, the path length and the GR dilation, so time dilation. So the fact is that by measuring these differences in time, the time delays, we should be able to measure some, you know, cosmological parameters, theoretically, especially like the Hubble constant. And so stepping back now and talking about kind of the problem that we are most excited about, and that has to do with the small-scale distribution of dark matter in the universe. So in the past few decades, multiple probes like, you know, BAO, weak lensing, CMB, and a lot of other things have mapped the large-scale structure of the universe very accurately and very precisely. And our measurements are in agreement with, with predictions of the cold dark matter model. But on smaller scale, on subgalactic scales, like the image that you see on the right, we still don't quite understand the detailed distribution of dark matter on very small scales. And this has become kind of like a hot topic in the past, you know, maybe two decades, because of a number of discrepancies in the Milky Way between the predictions of these simulations of, you know, cold dark matter models, you know, that like the thing that you see on the left, as opposed to the observations of dwarf satellites of the Milky Way that you see on the right here. So in N-body simulations, the halos of, you know, typical kind of Milky Way type galaxies have tens of thousands of these kind of like clumpy dark matter subhalos. And so the idea is that if each one of them also had like a tiny amount of baryonic matter and stars, we should observe, you know, tens of thousands of dwarf galaxies around the Milky Way. And in reality, we only observe 50. So this has been called the missing satellite problem. And there are generally two solutions proposed for it. The first solution is that these dark matter halos, subhalos, they exist according to CDM. We just can't see them because they don't have any baryonic matter in them. There's no stars, they're just there, we just don't know how to detect them. And so in this case, cold dark matter is fine. We just need to better understand the process of galaxy formation in these very low mass halos. And then the other possibility is that they really don't exist. And if they really don't exist, this is pointing to like some modifications in, you know, the dark matter particle properties. And so one possibility there is like a warm dark matter model with like, you know, different temperatures. And so as you tune that temperature, basically you're changing these kind of smoothness on kind of subgalactic scales. But on large scales, the predictions are basically identical to cold dark matter. So we're still in agreement with CDM on very large scales, but on small scales, it's different. So the idea here is that if we can map the small-scale distribution of dark matter on these scales observationally and differentiate between these two different pictures or other pictures, then we can actually like relate that to the properties of dark matter and the particle properties of dark matter and measure something interesting about it. And as you can imagine, we want to do this with strong lensing. And in fact, strong lensing is the only way that we can do this outside the Milky Way on these like tiny scales. So the idea is that if I have a background galaxy, a, you know, kind of rainbow color thing that you see there, and there's like multiple images, if the middle galaxy has a lot of subhalos, one of these subhalos might go and sit right in front of one of these images. And so by disturbing that image, by perturbing that image, you know, it's kind of like has an imprint there. And there's a difference between basically the lensing in that image as opposed to the lensing in the other images that are also kind of different versions of the same background source. So by comparing these different, you know, images of the background source, we can gain information about this extra level of lensing that's happening in one of them that allows us to detect these invisible dark matter subhalos and learn about their statistics. And so, you know, back to the wine glass analogy, now imagine that on the foot of the wine glass, if you had a water droplet, that water droplet, you know, so even in this case, by your eye, when you look at it, the only thing that your eyes see is a distortion in the image of the background candle. And immediately you know that there's something there, right? So we want to do the same thing, and by looking at these distortions, learn about the density field of the foreground galaxy. Except that the effect is like extremely subtle, right? It's not like as pronounced as that. So this is a simulation that one of my postdocs, Adam Coogan, you know, has written, and so you can play around with it. So these red dots are a population of dark matter subhalos according to CDM. So every time that I press the button here, you have a different realization of these subhalos. And if I turn off the light of the lensing galaxy and I just look at the arcs, you can, and I don't show the subhalos anymore, you can just see from realization to realization, there's this tiny perturbations in the arcs. So in one particular observation, we're going to see one of these realizations. I don't have a button to press, you know, for different galaxies to get different realizations. So the question is that from one of these realizations in one galaxy, or from a different realizations in like basically a population of galaxies, can I learn the statistics of this underlying subhalo population field? And so this is not a new thing. This work like was pioneered by Neil, who's here. So in 2002, this was like an amazing paper that Neil and Kochanik they wrote. And so basically they used about six or seven lens AGNs in radio to place constraints on the abundance of subhalos from lensing. The main issue was that, and the result was that they're consistent with CDM, but the uncertainties were still quite large. And the limiting factor at that point was observational data, having more kind of like lenses of that quality and that particular class that can allow us to improve the constraints. Unfortunately, that kind of class of lenses were not discovered, but a lot of other classes of lenses have been discovered ever since then. And a lot of different groups have been working in that, you know, for the past, whatever, like almost like 20 years now, including, you know, Simona Bigetti and groups, you know, led by Tommaso Trero and his students. But this is still kind of like an unsolved problem. And it is an unsolved problem today, in my opinion, primarily limited by our analysis methods. It is really, you know, kind of like not today, it's not really limited by data. We have a lot of data. There's like a lot of data. It's really limited by how do we analyze these gravitational lenses. It's kind of at some level computation and systematic limited. And so to kind of talk about that, I'm going to kind of talk a little bit about how we actually detect these lenses and what is that analysis method. Maybe I'll take a pause. Are there any questions? So the analysis of gravitational lenses, a lot of people call it lens modeling, basically boils down to inferring two sets of variables. We want to know what is the undistorted image of the background source, like the undistorted image of the candle. And we want to know what is the matter distribution in the foreground galaxy, like, you know, the shape of the wine glass. If you know these two sets of variables, like in these two sets of variables, we're done. We know everything about it. And you can just, you know, kind of understand that, you know, when you have a simulation. Like if I give you an image of a candle flame and a wine glass that distorts the image of the background, and I said, can we produce a simulation? It's pretty easy. What I do is that I get the wine glass, and I can calculate using ray tracing codes, I can calculate basically what's the deflection field. So I come up with like a vector field that tells me that every point has moved from point A to point B. That's the distortion. And I can get the image of the candle flame and move every pixel with that distortion field, and I have a lens image, right? So this is easy. The simulation pipe, you know, kind of the simulation part is easy. But the difficulty is like going the other way. When we have observed data, we don't know neither the background source nor the mapping, the lensing that has been done at the distortion. And, you know, we don't know about this kind of like inverse process that maps it back. And so what we do is that we just try to produce a lot of simulations with you know, things here drawn from some prior. And so the idea is that if I can produce simulations that really look like the observed data, then the parameters that I used here, then the background candle and the foreground lens that I used to produce those simulations have to be, you know, correct or have to be a version of the reality. And this comparison is done with some sort of like likelihood function. And so this is kind of like what you would call a likelihood-based, you know, lens modeling. And as you can imagine, it involves producing a lot of simulations most of which are kind of wasted because they're not going to look like anything like your observed data. But it's a very computationally expensive thing because you have to produce a lot of simulations every time that you have a data set to see which one of them are like the observed image, and then basically keep those and constrain your likelihood or your posterior. So when it comes to detecting these dark matter subhalos, the main idea is the same thing. The idea is that, can I compare two different models, one of them with no subhalos, one of them with one or multiple subhalos, and basically say, what is the ratio of this likelihood? Which one of them has, you know, higher probability of being a good description? And so if there are subhalos, ideally I should see that kind of, you know, basically be a better fit to the data as opposed to the smooth model. And so this is one example of like a work that we did. So here you're looking at the result of a simulation pipeline, basically doing this thing on two simulated data sets. So here, you know, we simulate the data, we know exactly what's the ground truth here. On the left, you have a smooth galaxy that there are no subhalos in it, it's just smooth kind of density. And the grayscale is showing the probability ratio between a model with and without a subhalo at different locations. So it's a map. Basically, this is the, you know, chi-squared, you can imagine, and so it tells you the significance. So black means that we are ruling out the presence of a subhalo. We're just saying that the smooth model is a better fit by a significance of like, you know, 5 sigma or more. A subhalo model would be kind of a worse kind of scenario. So it's good, you know, there are no subhalos, we are ruling them out. Here on the right, there is a subhalo at this location, the blue thing, and the red region there is showing that basically the model over some area prefers having a subhalo at that location. And so we applied this pipeline. Oh, so yeah, so this is another example. So you can see that the effect is so subtle. If I show you two images just like by eye, one with and one without a subhalo, it's impossible to see the difference between the two. But you know, if you actually get realistic of this, and you know, with realistic noise and realistic, you know, kind of all sorts of instrumental things, and put it through the pipeline, we can actually like detect these subhalos, you know, in the data, or at least the most massive subhalos, we can detect them in the data. And so this was a work that we did a few years ago with Neil, where we analyze this SDP81 data set. I'll just check the time, 20 minutes. So, and we had a detection of a dark matter subhalo in one location, and then exclusion of other subhalos of other masses over different regions of the sky. And then combining these detections and non-detections, we could place constraints on the mass function of dark matter subhalos in this particular system. So here you're looking at the density of these subhalos in projection, how many of them there are, as a function of their mass, that's the mass function, and the error bar and the upper bounds basically tell us what the mass function in this particular system is. And the gray band region here is telling us basically what are the predictions from cold dark matter, actually. So a little bit more complicated, they're kind of an extrapolation of the Dalang-Kochanek measurement, but more or less that's where the CDM kind of measurements are. And so we need to do better, so it's interesting that we're kind of consistent with CDM, but in fact, to really be able to conclusively say this, we need to have much better measurements, which comes from measurements of multiple sources. So we need more targets to be able to combine them together. And another interesting thing that we did a few years ago that I found really exciting was that so here we were looking at like individual massive subhalos, like say 10 to the 9 solar mass subhalos, where we can kind of like model them as one parameter in our model. But there should be, according to CDM, there should be like populations of much lower mass subhalos, and there's a lot of them. And so they would all mix and blend together, like how are we going to model that? And one of the ideas was that there's so many of them that we can basically consider this is like a continuous random density field, like a Gaussian random density field. And so by modeling like that, we can kind of just like, you know, learn something about the population of all the other subhalos. So when you look at frosted glass like this, you look at the images of background sources, you realize that they're like highly correlated, right? So and by eye, when you look at it, you don't think about the one particular like feature here, but overall, when you look at them, you just realize that they're highly correlated on some scale. And just by looking at the shape and the kind of the size of these correlations, intuitively, you know that the underlying that the glass has kind of like fine or coarse kind of texture to it, right? So we can do the same thing in strong lensing. And by modeling the correlations of these surface brightness things in the kind of after kind of the smooth lens model, relate that to the power spectrum of the density field. And so this was, you know, a work that, you know, we did with Neil to how to write that likelihood and how to actually like measure these correlations and relate it to the power spectrum of the density field, which is basically telling us, you know, what is the effect of the collective, you know, level of this subhead that's coming from this. And we had this Fisher forecast for what we could do with like one particular system if we had like very high quality data. So this is the power spectrum that we were talking about. And the error bars are showing basically in one system, we can actually measure this power spectrum if we have very, very good data. So how many lenses do we need to do better? That's the question. OK, so in one system, we can get some constraints. But how can we actually do that? So here, what I did is that I got that measurements of SCP-81 that we had. And I just like scaled them with square root of n, assuming like n independent observations of similar kind of quality, assuming cold dark matter, the black line here, to be the fiducial model. And then we just say, how many observations do we need to rule out dark matters, like warm dark matters of, you know, kind of different temperatures at 2 sigma, for example. And so we get this figure here, which basically tells us what is the mass of the warm dark matter model that we can rule out at 2 sigma as a function of like the number of lenses here. And so you can see that here, you know, with even like 10 lenses, we would be somewhere that is like, you know, quite competitive and very interesting. And so if you go to, you know, 100 lenses or something like that, you know, it's kind of groundbreaking in terms of the measurements that are possible in data. But the problem is that this is computationally very, very expensive. And also, from my perspective, the most important thing is that there's a lot of approximations, especially in the subhalos. Like I said, like a continuous field of subhalos, there's a lot of them, and there's like a high dimensionality of, you know, kind of like the sampling of this high dimensional space and kind of like the priors that are kind of like, you know, not exactly right. There's a lot of kind of details that, you know, I don't have the time, but there are issues that we have. And the thing is that the computational, the fact that it's computationally expensive also limits your ability to do really a lot of thorough tests of a lot of other systematics. And so this kind of like would get worse given that now we have like tens and hundreds of thousands of like, you know, gravitational lenses that are coming. So until a few years ago, we only knew of like a few hundred gravitational lenses altogether. Like when I started like, you know, kind of in this field like 10, 15 years ago, I think that number was about 100. And so when through the SPT-SMG, we discovered like 60 lenses, you know, it was a Nature paper, we put a press release. We were like, oh wow, we found 50 lenses. Now we know a couple of thousand lenses. LSST and Euclid are predicted to discover about like 200,000 lenses. I mean, this is like three orders of magnitude. It's a whole, you know, revolution in the field, if you can imagine. And there's, of course, a lot of fascinating and fantastic facilities for follow-up, you know, kind of like, you know, we can look at them with AlmaSum lenses, JWST, other future kind of upcoming kind of like 30-meter, you know, things. So we can have fantastic data of these lenses. But of course, the question is, how are we going to actually analyze this data, right? You know, the simplest modeling of a lens, even forget about substructure, like a macro model, it could take like, you know, 3-4 days minimum to many weeks. You know, people, even until like, you know, 2-3-4 years ago, people would kind of model like 4 or 5 lenses and write a paper. It was like, okay, that was like half of my thesis. And so now with 170,000 lenses, you know, you need like 1,400, you know, kind of human years. And unfortunately, the process is extremely unautomated and difficult. So this kind of like motivated us a few years ago to look into the use of machine learning for speeding up these calculations. And so I'm sure most of you have heard a lot about neural networks these days. So neural networks are universal function approximators. Just think about that. So it's a mathematical operation that basically takes in some data as input. It has a bunch of operations that are defined by these weights. And then as output, you know, it kind of has a prediction. And you can train it to kind of, you know, think about it like a line. When you fit a line through the data, it's, you know, a function approximator. Basically, you're fitting, and this neural network is a very complex form of that that can model very complex kind of behavior in the data. And so the idea here was that the difficulty in modeling these lenses comes from the fact that for every new target, I need to run all these simulations again from scratch. And that's because I don't know this relationship between the parameters and the data that I get except for running through my simulator. So can I basically train a neural network that does this inverse process, that just looks at the data directly and then kind of like maps it to the parameters that I'm interested in directly? And so before I kind of get into the details of that, I would like to kind of like differentiate between kind of like two different approaches or two different regimes of doing this. And that has to do with basically low versus higher dimensional representations of these problems. So if you look at the surface density, the surface brightness in the background source. So we want to kind of reconstruct the image of the background source, right? And that image, we could reconstruct it as a set of pixels, like the image that you actually see. And that pixel, you know, that image could have like 200 by 200 pixels. So that's 40,000 numbers. And that's a very high dimensional. So you can imagine that's in a 40,000 dimensional space. And it's a very high dimensional representation of that image. Another way that you can do it is like a very low dimensional representation. And think about it, a very blurry way of doing it is that you can say, well, it has a center x and y, some radius, some ellipticity, some angle with like 5, 6, 7, 10 surface profile, right? So it's a very low dimensional representation of the same problem. And so which way you go, it depends on exactly what you want to do and the quality of your data. If your data was extremely blurry, you're not going to see all these detailed structure in the thing. You've got to say maybe this low dimensional way of representing it is good enough. And if you have very high quality data and you're interested in a lot of things, so you might kind of like want to go there. So the first thing that I'm going to do is that I'm going to talk about these low dimensional representations. When the background source and the foreground lens, each of them are described by a handful of parameters. So altogether, we have about 10, 15, 20 parameters. So the work that we did a few years ago that kind of like started this was that we trained these convolutional neural networks to predict these like low dimensional representations. And so here you can see the ground truth in a bunch of simulations as a test, as a func. And so on the y-axis, there's the predictions of the networks for these. And so they can have a really, really good approximation to these lensing parameters, except that they do it like 10 million times faster, right? I can get the lens model for, you know, one particular lens in like a hundredth of a second on a single GPU. And the data points that you see here with the error bars, these are actually like HSC observations of a bunch of lenses with the error bars that come from previously published works from Alessandro Sonnenfeld. So we just got, you know, those data, threw it in the model, and so and they're consistent. So this is really exciting because, you know, imagine for LSSC, I said, you know, you need 1,400 years. Now, half an hour on a single laptop, you have basically a method to get a rough lens model for all of these lenses, for 200,000 lenses. And so this is really exciting. But in this first work, all we had was a point estimate. You know, so we had no uncertainties for these. Every prediction was, and so the data, the dots that you see here are basically from the test sample that we're using to assess the performance of this. But these were, there was no uncertainties. And so in the years since then, most of our efforts have been basically quantifying those uncertainties and understanding how to do that. And one of the first things that we did was to use these Bayesian neural networks, or approximate Bayesian neural networks, where now, instead of these deterministic weights in the network, they're defined by probability functions. And so by marginalizing over those probability, probabilities, we can get basically marginalized over these errors of the network and get an uncertainty at the end of the network. And for the output also, so I'm not gonna get into this, but there's this, you know, variational inference where we just say that, you know, the posterior, I can try to fit the posterior in a sense. So I can model that posterior with some parameters and turn this problem of inference and sampling into a problem of optimization of the parameters of this posterior.
So some of these Bayesian neural networks, you know, so you have these probability distributions for these internal parameters in the network. Are those probability distributions widths set by, like, you know, like a scatter in your training set, or is it set by observational error that you're
going to
put later on?
So the way that we did it is that to begin with, we just said, forget about like this, the probability of this. Let's say it's even fixed. The first thing that we do is that at the end of the network, we're not going to have a point estimate. We're going to predict a distribution, right? And that distribution could be a Gaussian distribution, so we need to predict a mean and a sigma, or it could be some other whatever distribution you like. So now you need to predict the parameters of that distribution. Now, in the limit that your network is going to do a perfect job, that distribution is going to be literally your posterior, you're done. So, but the issue is that the network is also making errors in those parameters of the distribution, right, as it's training. So you're training, you're showing different examples, you're writing this, like in this case, Gaussian likelihood, and training on this like log likelihood of the Gaussian thing. But then what you do is that you say, OK, so there is an error clearly here. So what I'm going to do is I basically just say that these distributions, well, these weights, they come from a distribution, so now they can like have different values. And this is called approximate Bayesian neural networks, because in reality, if you want to do this correctly, now you need to run an MCMC on the parameters of these weights. You can do it in like 20 weights or something like that. So people have done this theoretically, but it's impossible to do that. So what they do is that they say, okay, like these weights themselves, I'm going to do this like other variational inference on the weights, where I just say the weights themselves, they come from some known problem. I can just pick it out of the hat and just say, and in this case, the simplest case, it's a Bernoulli distribution. So basically, it's on or off with some value. You know, so it's just like one or the other. But the thing is that you have millions of these. So you can imagine some version of like, you know, a combination of these, and it still gives you a lot of flexibility to move around different places in the parameter space. And so sample that. So it basically tries to accommodate for kind of just like all the uncertainties that it didn't, you know, include in the fixed kind of like point estimate of these like these weights.
My question was about, you know, what setting, you know, like the width of the problem. So if I had like
the
any set with the width of those distributions,
I think it's the combination. It's a question of how expressive your network initially was, how well it could do that. You know, so if your network was just like so good for whatever reason, because it had a lot of weights, it was very expressive, it could do a really good job. And the posteriors that it got here, they had like no uncertainty, like it made very little error in that, then these widths would be probably very, very small. On the other hand, if you had a very poorly designed network that had a lot of kind of just like you couldn't, or this distribution or this variational distribution at the end was a very poor kind of like fit to the posterior. Let's say posterior had like high tails and like kind of like high kurtosis or something, then probably we try to accommodate for that by having high variance here. You know, so this is something that is kind of like learned during the training. Yeah.
So you're not sampling the weights by your training. You learn the distribution of weights after you train.
No, during the training, you're sampling there, right? So you're so every training, basically, you're sampling from these like different like the distribution that comes, right? So there's a Monte Carlo process of like these weights being drawn.
But you don't specify the distribution of weights before you start.
You specify what is the distribution. You're learning the parameters of that distribution. So you can think about it, they could be Gaussian. They could be Gaussian. You can say these are drawn from a Gaussian, but I'm learning what's the mean and the variance. You know? And that's the whole premise of variation. So variational inference basically just boils down to exactly doing that. You come up with some functional form for whatever, you know, probability that you're trying to infer, and then you're turning, instead of like, you know, you're just turning into optimization of the parameters of it, it's trying to fit the distributions to each other. So that was 2017. So now we have realized that there's a much, much, much better way of doing this that we talked with Neil yesterday. And that's, you know, through this, like, you know, what we used to call likelihood-free inference, the terminology is changing almost every day in the field. So people like to call it now implicit likelihood, you know, inference and things like that, but it doesn't matter. The point is that it really boils down to first training basically a neural net that just gives you a point estimate. So what we do here is that the first thing that we do is just like before. So I draw parameters from my prior. I kind of like simulate, you know, a training set, and I train in, I produce a training set, and I train a convolutional neural network that tries to kind of like predict the same parameters back. It gives me only a point estimate. It doesn't give me uncertainties. Then what I do is that I draw again. So once the CNN is trained, I don't touch it anymore. Right? I'm not retraining anything anymore. So what I do now is that I draw these parameters from the prior, again, a second data set, right? So the first data set was used to train. A second data set, the parameters are actually drawn from the prior. I put it through the simulator. I get a bunch of simulations. So for this simulation, I know what the ground truth is. It's here. I put them through this previously trained convolutional neural network, and I get a bunch of predictions for it. Okay, so now I have basically predictions for the ground truth, right? And then what I do is that I go and I model the joint distribution of these two different things. So you can just imagine that, you know, there's a, you know, if I just put all of these, there's some distribution in the truth versus measurement. And now I have a real data set that I want to analyze. And that real data set, you know, is X. I put that real data set also in my trained CNN, the same trained CNN. It gives me a prediction for whatever it is. And so what I do now is that I get the conditional probability of the thing that I have, you know, given the data that I have, the measurement that I have. And this is actually, you know, honest to God, posterior, as long as these simulations actually came from the physical process that you're talking about. And the idea here is that this is very similar to Monte Carloing your data. So if you have worked a little bit in that, you know that there's basically two different ways to analyze data. One is that you know the density of your noise, and so you can write your likelihood and you can sample it with something like an MCMC. Alternatively, you can simulate your noise, but maybe you don't know the density, or maybe for whatever reason you don't want to do it. So you can Monte Carlo the same likelihood by doing realizations of the noise and then looking at this thing. So it's a very similar thing here. The only thing that we have done is that instead of the data, we have done some sort of compression of the data, which is the prediction of the network that we put in there. So these are, you know, the results. So the question is, are these uncertainties like accurate? And to test that, we measure this thing called a coverage probability, which basically says that if you come up with, you know, if you tell me that this is the posterior for something, I can repeat this experiment many times and just ask myself, for example, if I get a part of this that contains like 68% of the probability, you know, does the ground truth fall within this value kind of by 68% of the time, right? If it does, then it's accurate. If it doesn't, if my ground truth like falls, you know, out here in like 80% of the time, this is a terrible probability, right? It just means that I'm inaccurate, that I have a bias or whatever. So in the perfect scenario, you'll be like on this x equal y-axis, which basically says what is the corresponding ratio, kind of like fraction of points falling in that particular probability volume. And so you get like perfect results with this case. And as you can see, you can do this in many dimensions. And so you can get a posterior of these lenses that you can, you know, look at. Good thing about this is that it gives you the full joint posterior. It's very accurate. You can have arbitrary priors at inference time. So what we can do is that at inference time, we can just basically, if I had a different lens and a different lens and they had different priors on them, I can put these Bayesian priors and I can get the posteriors however I want. It's amortized, and amortized in the machine learning kind of like jargon, it means something that basically has done the learning before. I don't need to retrain it or you know, an MCMC is not an amortized thing. Every time I have a new data set, I have to generate new simulations and do it again and again and again. Whereas here, basically, you've done this computational kind of thing once, the training, the whatever. Every time you have a new data, you just need to read it, you know, things, read it off. The bad thing about it is that it's only feasible for low-dimensional variable inference. Like I said, low-dimensional representations of these things, like, you know, 10, 20 parameters like that. And another kind of interesting thing that we've done with it is to just say, okay, like I have these like posteriors for individual lenses, but what if I was interested in some sort of hyperparameter, some maybe distribution of these things? You know, if I was interested in the distribution of the masses of galaxies, for example, how can I do that? And so you can do this like, one way to do it is to do it through a hierarchical Bayesian inference, kind of hierarchical Bayesian model. And so, you know, it's just like, you know, statistical model, you can write, you know, what that is. One complication is that a lot of times your data, you know, are going through some complex selection, where some of the data you don't observe them because of, you know, however they were selected. And if you don't account for that, you're gonna get basically biased results. And doing this hierarchical Bayesian inference means that, correctly, it means that every time you're doing running an MCMC on that, for every point, you need to run a lot of simulations to basically quantify that selection, see what fraction of things actually get detected, and reweight your posteriors according to that. And so this is the work that my student Ronan and one of our postdocs, Connor Stone, they did together, where basically they're quantifying this selection function with a neural network that looks at some lens detection, you know, machine that had, it's another neural network, it's another convolutional neural network that basically selects the lenses. And so they put simulations in that and they learn what is the fraction of lenses as a function of the parameters that go through, you know, that get selected as of, you know, or not. And so they show this plot where basically they have this experiment. The star is showing the parameters of this like hyperdistribution. And if they don't account for this selection, they get this bias estimate. But when they put this kind of neural network learned selection, they can basically correct for it and get the orange contours of this thing. And so you can imagine that I'm very excited about the extension of this to this like dark matter thing, because you can imagine like dark matter subhalo is basically, it's the idea is that it's something universal that we are trying to learn from a population of lenses, and there's complex selections going on. And so if we can simulate those selections and do something similar, basically can, we can account for that in our models. So one more very popular thing these days that people use is called these like neural ratio estimators. And the neural ratio estimators have the advantage of being able to implicitly marginalize over a large number of parameters. And there's like a few different flavors of them. But they all boil down to the problem of estimating the posterior to the problem of kind of like being able to classify between two different kind of like samples coming from two different distributions. So you have, during training, you have two different distributions like class one and class two drawn from two different probability distributions. And then you try to classify them. And the classifier basically boils down to the, you know, ratio of these two different distributions. And so I said there's different flavors of them. One of them, for example, is to try to kind of like, you know, boil it down to the ratio of the probability of X, the data, and theta, the parameter associated with the data, and the probability of the product of the marginals, which is basically random, everything shuffled together. And then you can just show that, you know, using that, you can measure this, this posterior. The bad thing about it, in my opinion, is that number one is that you cannot account for this epistemic uncertainty, the thing that we talked about, like the Bayesian neural network. So your network is basically, you know, kind of like doing a classification here, but you don't know how much error it's actually making in that and how to account for that. And the other issue here for lensing is that you're not recovering the, all the detailed information about it, because you're just looking at very low dimensional statistics. But they've been very powerful. So Adam Coogan, one of my postdocs, and a lot of other people, Siddharth Mishra Sharma, some people from Stanford have been writing these papers showing that you can train these neural ratio estimators to get the posteriors of these dark matter subhalos. And so here you're looking at the mass of the dark matter subhalo from just basically a bunch of samples. These are all unsimulated data, and do it. In my personal opinion, I think the amazing thing about them, the good use for them, is actually to do sensitivity analysis, right? Because you don't get the detailed distribution, so you cannot verify the data. But I think there would be very good tools for basically forecasting and you know, some sort of different version of like Fisher forecast for upcoming data. And so I have maybe like 10 minutes. I'll kind of like talk briefly about kind of the most recent thing that we've done that I'm very, very excited about. And that kind of goes to this like high dimensional representation. So everything we talked about right now was like 10, 20 parameters. And so now the question is that, can I actually reconstruct the image of the background source like this? You know, I don't want to kind of like represent it by X and Y and R by an image. And for the foreground too, instead of just like saying it's some, you know, kind of some mass or some ellipticity, I actually want to kind of produce a map, an image of density in the lensing galaxy. And that's the work that Alex Adam, who's a PhD student working with us, has been leading. One of the first things that he did was that he trained this like recurrent inference machine that would predict this background source and the foreground lens. So the red here is basically mass density in the foreground, and the background source is basically image of the background source with this neural network. One thing that we really loved about this work was that the machine learning was only doing the job of the optimization of this physical model. So we actually have this like ray tracing simulation. So we start from some place in the parameter space. It could be zeros, or it could be some whatever that you like. You do an actual ray tracing simulation. You have this simulated model, just like you would do in MCMC. You have the data, you compute the likelihood. And now what you do is that you take the derivative of that, like the gradient of that likelihood with respect to these parameters here. These are x, And then you feed that to this neural network that is a recurrent neural network that has some memory of like where it has been, and it basically tells you where to go next. So it does the job of the optimization of this like posterior. But why do we do that as opposed to some sort of downhill, you know, gradient optimization? The reason is that we learn these priors that are in here implicitly. So if you weren't, if you instead of this recurrent inference machine had just like a downhill, you know, gradient optimizer, you realize that you have so many pixels here that you're going to overfit the data. You're going to start fitting to noise. You don't have the priors to consider because you have too many parameters. And that is like one of the main challenges, or the main challenge in reconstructing these high dimensional representations, is learning the priors. But these neural networks, through this training, it learns what these priors are and so can reconstruct these without overfitting to the data.
Wait, so how does that work? Sorry.
So during training, because the training of this model, so you get, you compute the likelihood, you give the gradient of the likelihood to this, it makes a new prediction, but your loss, your machine learning loss here, is the difference between the pixels, is the mean squared error between this and the ground truth, because you know what the reality is, right? Because for both of these, you know, it's, you have a training data where you know what the reality is, right?
Oh, so you're training on some set of realistic
galaxies. Yeah.
Oh.
And so during training, your loss is the difference between basically the predictions and your training data.
So you also have been training on like, you know, realistic mass distributions?
Yes. So the training set has these realistic mass distributions in the foreground. They come from illustrious simulation or whatever else you like. Background sources, some images of galaxies or whatever that it is. So during training, you are doing this operation, but the thing that drives the weights of the network, when you're doing backpropagation in the network, the loss that you use is the reconstruction loss here. Because you were saying, I want this to be as close as possible to the ground truth. Right? So your network implicitly through that operation learns the priors that you have in here, that like things are smooth on some level, that you know you don't have like high frequency, that things are not negative, et cetera, et cetera. It learns the structure in the prior in the data. And so later for a data set, you don't have these, you put the same thing and you get your prediction.
So then if I want to apply this, you know, I mean, like, you know, we're studying different types, so let's say models, then our training set would have to
include the different things. Yes. So these are like some examples of this. So these are kind of the performance on test data sets. So you can see these are the ground truth background, the predictions for the background, the ground truth foreground, the predictions for the foreground, and the predicted, you know, the actual, you know, images and the predictions and the noise. Now, this, in my opinion, this is just like crazy. I mean, like if 10 years ago I saw this, I would have like just like cried or something. I still want to cry because I used to model these lenses, and once you have even two or three blobs or lenses, and you see the galaxies in real data, like in optical data, fitting them is so difficult. This is such a crazy nonlinear problem to figure out where they are, how they go, what the masses are, to get some crazy image configuration like this is tremendously difficult, like with optimizers. This parameter space is so highly kind of like complex and so many local minima and so many things. So just the fact that you can just like, you know, put it in and like, you know, a second, you know, get these predictions is quite amazing. But this work, again, like before, it didn't have the uncertainty. So this is just a point estimate. You know, we're just doing an optimization to just find like a maximum likelihood or maximum posterior map estimate for these things. So the most recent work that, you know, we just submitted last week that I'm very, very excited about is actually doing this and sampling from the posteriors in these high dimensional spaces. And so you can imagine that, you know, this is just your regular kind of, you know, Bayes theorem where you just say the probability of like the data X, sorry, the model parameter X, which could include the foreground or the background. In this case, so we were just talking about the background in this particular example. The background, given the data, is the likelihood or the log of the likelihood plus the log of the prior, and so minus the log of the evidence. So what you can do is that you can take the gradient of these things with respect to the parameters X. What in the machine learning kind of communities is called the score, you know, of a function. So the score is basically that gradient. And so we can learn that from training data. So these are a class of generative models in machine learning called score-based models. And the reason that they do this is that it's just numerically much easier to deal with and much more stable to deal with this gradient because it doesn't depend on the normalization factor of this function. So your probability function, its normalization, if you're trying to actually learn the probability, is like much harder numerically. But once you just try to look at the gradient, it's much easier to deal with. So these score-based models, they can learn that. But what we are doing here is that we just say, okay, like if I can sample that, and the sampling is usually done with, if you can use it, you can use Hamiltonian Monte Carlo if you wanted to, or we are doing like Langevin sampling here. But what we do here is that we just say we train that score-based model on the prior, so it's giving us the prior, but now we can get the score of the likelihood piece after that and then actually sample from the posterior. And so these are just like some of the results. So here you're looking at 16 different realizations of this background source, that are shown here for one particular data set. And they look very similar, but if you look at them, the fine structure in them, there's like slightly different. You can see tiny variations here. You have this blob, you don't have it here. And these are consistent with basically the posterior. It's really, really fascinating to see this. So here, what we have done is that we get these different reconstructions, and we just look at the RMS, the standard deviation per pixel, and map that on top. And it's just really funny. I mean, you can just see your expectations that where you have the caustics, the black stuff, your uncertainty is much lower because those are the areas of high magnification where you have better constraints. And as you go out, your uncertainty like increases because you have less constraining power from the likelihood. One really fun experiment that we did is that we just said, hey, let's look at this like for some out-of-distribution sample where we just get an image of 7 and then lens it to produce this thing and then try to reconstruct it with the same model. And you can see that in this case, where you have very little noise and the data is very constraining, the likelihood is very informative, you can recover it back. But as you add more and more noise to the data, now your likelihood is not informative anymore. And your prior piece starts dominating. But here, your prior is basically images of galaxies. Your prior is not some simple, like, Gaussian form or something like that. And in fact, I can draw many different, like, samples out of it. So here, you look at different samples. You can see that as you go to, like, pure noise, you're back to sampling from the prior, which is basically random images of galaxies. And it's just really interesting to see that, this transition going from, 7 to galaxy in kind of the competition between the prior and the likelihood. And so, so this is, again, work that has been led by Alex Adam and Adam Coogan. So, and it's really exciting. So, what's that?
No, sorry, it's just like, these are all my exponents, so I was just like reacting, but not.
Okay. But we're also using machine learning for other aspects of this analysis. And one of them is like, for this speeding up the simulations themselves. In the past, 5-6 years, we realized that actually the subhalos in the lensing galaxy matter much less because the halos along the line of sight in the whole universe actually have a much kind of stronger signal in our things that we cannot just ignore them. And so if I want to model those like halos at kind of like all the different redshifts, I need to do these ray tracing simulations that go, through the whole kind of like light cone from redshift to redshift. It's a recursive thing, and it's very expensive to do. And so what my student Charles and Adam, they were doing is basically using these machine learning models that get at the position x, y, and a set of parameters for these subhalo populations. Instead of doing this recursive thing, they can just like jump to the background source and do this ray tracing really, really fast. And so what they're doing is basically this combination of like a set transformer, that's the thing that you see on top, that basically gets a list of these subhalos and compresses them to some kind of uniform kind of like summary statistic. And in combination with this kind of like, MLP model that does that. And so the model is still not like doing perfect at high frequencies. Like you can see here, these are the predictions. These are the ground truth. But we're getting there. And it's really exciting to see this kind of like working much, much faster for data. I'm going to skip talking about H-naught. I wanted to just mention that H-naught is another kind of thing that you can do with lensing. We mentioned it, that there's a time delay between these different signals. And so we have a student, Ev, who's been using these like neural ratio estimators to kind of see if we can use them to measure H-naught from lensing. There's a lot of, this would be probably like a week-long conference itself to discuss this. So I'm going to skip it. But a lot of these lensing things, they kind of like go under this umbrella of this analysis pipeline for strong lensing data in upcoming service, especially like LSST and Euclid. And so this is a collaboration with people in New York at CUNY and Flatiron Institute. Another kind of like major project that we're involved in now is this Simons collaboration on learning the universe, which is an 8-institution kind of like collaboration. And the goals here are basically using machine learning to enable these cosmological kind of inference of cosmological parameters and reconstructing the initial conditions of the universe at high redshift with this data. There's a bunch of like, you know, few other projects. One of that, you know, that people from our group are doing. One of them is using unsupervised learning to look at Gaia data and basically construct, you know, develop unsupervised learning things to detect anomalies in data. And like, how can we actually find anomalies? How could we make them, these kind of anomaly detection methods kind of more interpretable and things like that? This is a work that's, you know, kind of being led by Vinit Jain, who's a student with Siamak Ravambash, who's a machine learning faculty at Mila, and my student Claudia, and one of my postdocs, Mario Pascato, who are doing this. And a lot of other projects that I don't have time to mention. So Pablo Lemos is a joint postdoc with us and CCA. He's working, you know, in this Poisson sampling with GFLOW nets that are quite, and reinforcement learning, that's really fun. Laura Leozzi is kind of like extending these things to cluster lenses, and which is like a much harder problem. And Connor Stone is a CETA National Fellow coming to Montreal working on these stellar masses. So the question is, can we combine stellar populations modeling and strong lensing modeling to basically these kind of like joint probe of the density and do a self-consistent model there and a lot of other things. So finally, in the last minute, I just want to say these kind of like works have kind of inspired us to make this kind of like have this new initiative to have a research institute at the intersection of machine learning and astrophysics. And so the idea is to focus on computational aspects of astrophysics. And it's kind of like a project-oriented, you know, initiative at this point with kind of in collaboration with Mila and Ivado. For those of you who don't know, Mila is this, you know, this is the world's like largest deep learning institute. It's in Montreal with like over like 1,000 people now involved in it. And so this is our current team working in that. This is just like became official as of like 2 weeks ago. So it's like still pretty new. It's me, Laurence Perrault-Levasseur, Siamak Ravambash is in computer science. Julie Lavashek-Larondo, who does black holes and feedback. Derek Nourzi-Zahrai, who's a machine learning expert, but has worked for many years in physical kind of modeling of systems. And Guy Wolf, who's in statistics and machine learning. And so Yasha Benjo, the director of Mila, Luke Vina, the director of Ivado, and David Spergel, the director of the Simons Foundation, they've been basically the on the board and advisors to the project as we go. And one of the first kind of like events that we've done in that direction of this new place is having this like astromatic summer school that we had in August. So we basically brought like about 15 undergraduate students from around the world, had this really fun event of, you know, a bunch of courses, a bunch of like, you know, hackathons and experiments, and, you know, just like, and we are kind of doing a lot of other things in the coming years. So if you're interested in visiting us or doing anything or learning more about what we are doing, please feel free to come talk to me, and I'll stop there. Thank you.
I can't see what time it is. Okay, so.
I can start off maybe. I mean, yes, you mentioned this Gaia anomaly detection. Like, can you elaborate more on what you're planning with that?
So anomaly detection is at in principle, it's just like a pretty simple idea. The idea is that if you have data that is in some space, you know, can you find outliers? And so there's like, you know, different ways that you can do this. And, you know, one way to do it is that you can just like fit the data, you know, fit some density, basically estimate the density. And if you estimate the density, then you can just go to the tails of this density and figure out if there's data there that is kind of like, you know, at the outliers of this distribution.
So your density would mean something like the phase density of stars, or
For example, yes, yes. For example, it could be that, or it could be the density of all the variables. So, so Gaia gives you this catalog that has 40 like variables. Like, you know, you can have temperature of the star. You can have, you know, the phase space density 6 plus like all the other ones. So in that space, you can imagine that there's regions where they're very high density. There are regions where you have one star like really far from everything else in that like 40 dimensional space, for example. And so the work that we are doing with CLMAC is kind of just like some new machine learning kind of like, you know, kind of development kind of at the machine learning level. It's kind of like interesting new things that that we are doing in kind of just like how to do this, and especially how to do this in a way that is invariant towards kind of like different kind of like transformations, like how you kind of turn the data around and how do you kind of define these parameters. Because you can imagine that if you kind of stretch and squeeze this distribution, you can change what the definition of what an outlier is. A lot of this has kind of like been focused, like how do we do that? My personal interest in this is something that is unanswered, honestly, at this point, is that what a machine learning expert calls an outlier or an anomaly is an outlier in the data space. What I consider an anomaly is the difference between whatever we observe and theoretical understanding or like models, right? So like sometimes maybe like half of the data is anomalous because it just goes against, you know, some aspect of what we think it should be. So, and so, you know, I've been kind of thinking, you know, the past year about kind of like, how do we actually kind of like find those sort of anomalies that it's not necessarily dependent on the fact that there's like very few examples around. So it kind of like boils down to interpretability and physical models, kind of like, you know, can I input some of my understanding and simulators and physical models into these systems to figure out what are the aspects or dimensions that are different from, you know, kind of like theoretical predictions?
Okay. Yeah, for things maybe like the phase space spiral, which is like somewhat anomalous.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Any last questions?
Yeah, please. So just a clarification, are you still working on the load representation sort of mode, or is that something you sort of abandoned and you of the hyper-presentation?
It's not abandoned because you need that. And sometimes that's just like perfectly good enough. Like, you know, if you look at, say, you know, LSST will, you know, have first light, I think, in a year. The data, if you simulate the data, it's like extremely low resolution, extremely noisy, right? So it's very clear that, you know, with a Cirsich model and a background, you know, for the background, some SI plus shear model, you're going to get a pretty good representation of this thing. And so, no, it is not abandoned. I think that there, from my perspective, what has been done is, you know, in terms of posterior kind of quantification is almost there, but there's a lot of other aspects of it that that still, you know, we could work on, yeah.
Okay.
And then, do any of your results from your sort of low-dimensional representation analysis inform your high-dimensional representation, or vice versa? Is there sort of like a bridge to be drawn between these two modes that reveals more? That's a very good question. We haven't done that, but we have kind of like thought about it a little bit. In the posterior sampling that I mentioned in like high-dimensional basic reconstructions. One of the things, so right now we have this basically diffusion process for the sampling, the Langevin kind of dynamics for sampling. And one of the ideas that we've had is that if I was in, like, instead of starting from pure noise, so you can imagine that you have this, like, diffusion thing. So you, now you're doing the reverse of the diffusion process, right? In, like, reverse time diffusion. Instead of diffusing this back to complete noise and then going back, can I start somewhere close and make it much faster to converge? And so in that scenario, you can imagine that, yes, a low-dimensional representation would give you a much better starting point and much faster convergence, you know, everything. Yeah, I think it would be interesting to look into that, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, good. So let's stop here. The after will be around for the rest of the day. And
yeah, and maybe tomorrow morning, yeah.
Tomorrow morning as well. I'm also taking in dinner. So let me know if you're interested in joining for dinner. Thanks again, Yasser, for a great talk.
All right. Thank you, Dina. Thank you.